It's 25 to 5. The panel are NZ National. Richard in Waipu says, I'm an ex-teacher who remembers teaching students in the school swimming pool. It was not a big pool, so we concentrated on water confidence and water skills. The pupil I remember clearly was the boy, about 9, who was almost terrified of water. I worked on his confidence, and the class was extremely delighted and cheered when he not only put his head under the water, but also touched the bottom of the pool. But the health and safety at the time did make it difficult for schools to operate pools, and that might have a bit to answer for. Lovely to have your company this afternoon. Well, yesterday, panellist Alexia Russell brought up the issue in her I've Been Thinking About the Ways That We Need to Design Buildings. She mentioned in particular modernist style glass buildings, which might look just amazing, but are expensive to run. And this echoes a recent article that states advances in artificial cooling, heating and computer-aided design have introduced wasteful building styles that are less environmentally friendly. And it got us thinking, is there a better way for buildings to cope with the heat and in a more efficient way, because gosh, it is getting hot. We thought we'd get Andrew Eagles from the Green Building Council on the show to share his thoughts on this. Kia ora, Andrew.
Kia ora, great to be here.
Nice to have you on. Actually, Alexia mentioned a very simple idea here. She said they're having a deck reno, and they've decided to do a southern-facing deck to future-proof, because it's getting very hot. You want to sit in the shade on your deck and not in the sun. Simple example.
Well, exactly. You know, some of this can be pretty basic, thinking about getting shading. And, you know, in the Mediterranean, they've thought about using shading for centuries. And so I think there are some key basic elements. We're not required to consider orientation in the building code, but it's a really key way that we can shade our buildings. We can recess our windows, consider planting and how that can provide shading for our buildings. We're going to get a lot more heat, so it's really key we focus on that.
Hang on, recessing windows, what's that about and why does that make it cooler?
Well, so the window sits further back in the building, and so you get slightly more shading as the sun comes across. You don't get as much sun coming into your building during the midday heat, so that's helpful because there's not much sun coming through and hitting the floor of the building. I mean, I think the article was good, and it's a really good point to make. The energy we use to run our buildings is about 10% of total emissions, and this heat makes it uncomfortable, particularly for vulnerable people. So it's really important we start to focus on this and look at those passive principles and design better. I think in the future we're going to see less of this whole glazing to the whole facade.
Oh, we are?
And we want to move away from that. Yep.
Because there seems to be a sense of, and I'll bring the panellists very shortly, of relying on aircon, because the article talks of these fully glazed facades without shading devices that started, you know, dominating cities. You've got the skyscrapers or the flash glass buildings. And thanks to cheaper aircon systems, you could cool it down, but at a big cost.
Yeah. So a couple of things are going to drive change here. One is a really big driver to reduce the energy use in buildings coming through the building code. So we've had a relatively minor change, but then bigger change coming over the next 5 to 6 years from MBIE. And then the more significant change is a check in the how buildings operate. So it's measuring each year how much energy is used and looking to ratchet that down every year. So that's through a program called NABERS that was mandated in Australia in 2006.
All right. And listeners might want to text in on how they, little tips to help cool down their home, because goodness knows our home is very, very hot. We try opening the back door, the big front. We've got sort of some big front windows trying to get a draft through. Zoe George.
Yeah, I love this subject. And actually, a friend of mine spoke about this last year. Her and I did a TEDx talk here in Wellington, and she spoke about biomimicry in architecture, which looked at thermal adaptation of buildings and how we look at things like plants and animals and how they adapt to heat and self-regulate in heat. And one of the things that she looked at was the design and structure of termite mounds and how they're built and how they self-regulate. And applying that possibly to the way that we design and become more smart around our building designs. And I just found that whole notion of looking to nature to then apply to things that we're going to use was just so incredibly smart. Her name is Dr. Negin Imani. She's currently based down in Dunedin, but I think she's coming back to Wellington. And it's just fascinating because animals and plants do self-regulate. So I wonder how we can apply the learnings from that area and put it into our buildings.
Andrew?
I know, Dr. Imani. And there is, thermal mass, partly what the termites are using. We can't do everything they're doing, but we can use some of that thermal mass to soak up the heat and then release it slowly. So there's some elements there. Yep.
Liam?
Yeah, well, I'm no expert or even really that informed on this issue, but I do have to say it made me think about the Palace of the Parliament in Romania, which was on these big brutalist buildings built by Ceausescu. And it has no air conditioning. It's one of the biggest buildings in the world. It has no air conditioning, and it's all designed so that the air would flow through it sort of naturally. And the reason why it was done that way wasn't any out of environmental concern. It was because Ceausescu was paranoid about being poisoned through the air conditioning system. So, if Romania could do it in the 60s and 70s or whatever, I'm sure that we can pull it off now.
Yeah, there is a really key tip for people is just to get the cross ventilation going. You know, and I was in London for a long time. They were looking at a lot of heat you get in cities from the urban heat island effect. So cities just heat up from the concrete and the glass and things. And one of the things they required is an apartment to allow ventilation to go through a building. So you have where you have windows across from each other or doors outside, try and get that breeze moving through the apartment. That can really help. A really key element to all of this that we'll see far more of, which will ratchet down the glazing of our buildings, is the requirement to think about embodied carbon. And that's the materials we use when we build and the carbon it takes to create those. And glazing is far more intensive than standard wall. So what you'll see as government starts to require lower embodied carbon is people saying, well, I can't meet the requirements. We're going to reduce the amount of window we have or glazing we have in these walls and these homes. And I think that's really important. Our building code isn't fit for purpose, and we need to do maybe not go to the extent of the termites fully, but we do need to think about healthier homes and lower carbon operating homes and buildings.
Now, a bit of response to this, I taught in remote Australian schools. Many of them have breezeways. We don't need such flash houses. Wallace says, Murray, keep your house cool by opening windows at night. Then keep the air cool by keeping windows closed and curtains pulled during the day. This keeps my house several degrees cooler than the outside temperature. Just finally, it might be a bit of a side angle, Andrew, but I just want to touch on this movement of painting roofs white.
Yes, I was going to touch on that. So as driving back from my holiday, we had standard 25 degrees, you know, in Taupo and other places. And I noticed all of the houses in just outside of Auckland there were all dark, their roofs. And you will have seen in Australia they've just regulated that you can't have dark coloured roofs. So it's very clear that it does help reduce the heat. It just seems an absolute great opportunity to reduce the overheating of buildings where we can do that. Other places have painted their buses white. We can help reflect that heat up and increase our homes and buildings. Yep.
Very interesting, Andrew. Thanks for being on the program. That is Andrew Eagle, who's the Green Building Council. Painting the roofs white, would you like to see more of that happen in Aotearoa? Thomas says the new building at Victoria of Wellington is not good for those working in it. It looks flash, but wow, it's brutally hot in summer and it's cold in winter, despite the air conditioning blasting occupants continuously. And it's way too glary to see a computer screen. It's 15 to 5, the panel, RNZ National. In a completely different subject, news out of the UK that the BBC licence fee is to be abolished in 2027 and funding frozen. The BBC will have to negotiate with the government over an entirely new funding model when the final licence fee funding deal expires in 2027, with potential options including a subscription service for the BBC, part privatisation of the BBC, or direct government funding. It raises issues about the long-term financial future and editorial independence of the public service broadcaster under a Conservative government. So is this the end of the Beeb? And does anyone, by the way, recall the days in Aotearoa when you used to pay a $110 a year public broadcasting fee? You can text us 2101. With us now is Dr. Peter Thompson. He's the director of the communication program at Te Herenga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington. Kia ora, Dr. Thompson.
Kia ora.
What does this mean? It's hard to imagine UK life without the BBC as we know it.
Well, being a POM, I'd have to agree. In my view, it's a shameless and self-interested act of political vandalism by a Conservative Party currently trying to defend the continuing tenure of its dubious Prime Minister.
That's a bit heavy, isn't it?
Well, no, I think it's entirely justified. Really, what they're proposing would completely undermine the institutional foundations of the BBC as a public broadcaster.
Would anyone care?
It would undermine public media services fundamentally in the UK.
Would the UKs care? Would the Britons care?
I think an awful lot of Britons would be very happy not to pay a licence fee. I mean, anything that costs us money tends to engender resentment. And I think what's happened in the digital media environment is that the range of choices of subscription media have diluted the sense that public media and where you pay a licence fee is delivering value for money. People are quite happy to subscribe to Netflix if you get Game of Thrones or other binge watch fest types of material. And I think that in that environment, it's hard to sustain the perception that the licence fee is nevertheless a very, very important public investment, in cultural and social value.
It's quite an extraordinary story. I mean, the BBC licence fee, the Beeb no less, the fee to be abolished. Could it really happen?
Well, it could. This is part of a much, much longer story. I mean, if we go back to the 1980s, in 1986 was the Peacock Report, commissioned under the Thatcher government, which was clearly motivated to try and find a way to undermine the BBC as a public service operator. And yet Peacock, who is very much a neoliberal economist, still came to the conclusion that there was no better solution than a licence fee supporting a public service media operator. So, when they looked at it very, very closely, the alternatives were all worse. And I worry that the current government in the UK really has no conception of this history and certainly hasn't considered whether or not the alternatives are better.
Let's jump in with our panellists. Liam, you first on this. What do you make of it? What thoughts do you have?
Well, I mean, as you say, I think it was 1999 when we scrapped the license fee here because I was in third form. I remember it was in the first week of school, third form, that it was announced. So I haven't really ever grown up having much experience with that as a funding model. And I've always had in my life, had that sort of mixed commercial public role, which, probably doesn't either very well. But not to inject too much contention into proceedings, but I mean, you have to say, look, this has been a long time coming in terms of what a Conservative government might government might actually do, because there's been a long-standing perception that the BBC caters to a sort of to a political viewpoint that's quite adverse to the Conservative Party or, you know, political conservatives. And you don't have to take my word for that. Mark Thompson, who was the Director General of the BBC for like 6 years, he said that a few years ago, that it was just a fact. And so, it's been on a hit list for conservatives for a long time who think, well, why is the public funding a service which is politically adversarial to us and to a large part of the country? And so, you know, any opportunity that they have to cut the BBC down to size, like, you know, I'm not really surprised that they would take it. And I guess it's a bit of a warning sign for public broadcasters that that they are ultimately at the mercy of politicians.
Peter.
Oh, well, I'd agree with a lot of that, except fundamentally the irony here is that the BBC isn't particularly biased towards the left. Culturally, it's probably errs on the side of a liberal perspective, but in terms of its political and economic representation, there's actually quite a lot of evidence that suggests that it's lurched more towards the right. So, I mean, the classic argument, of course, for public service broadcasters is when they've got politicians on both the right and the left complaining that they're biased, they've probably got it right. Certainly it would seem extremely obtuse for a government within a democratic society to try and remove an independent public broadcaster. Now, there are all sorts of other measures you can put in place to ensure its editorial independence and its balance. You certainly don't privatise it, because that simply hands it over to the vicissitudes and the demands of advertisers or subscribers. You know, so really, it's a very, very poorly thought out, you know, approach to reforming public media. There may be arguments for a different form of funding, but there's certainly no argument for removing the independence of a public media entity.
Better response to this about your memories of the licence fee. I recall the Post and Telegraph spy trucks driving around Otago University flats with antennas trying to detect unlicensed radio or TVs, like some sort of East European country in the early 70s. Zoe, what of this topic?
Yeah, I'm really gutted to hear that we may lose the BBC. I'm all for fully funded independent public broadcasters, just like Radio New Zealand, the station that we're on right now. We are the fourth estate and we play a very vital role in upholding democracy. And one of the things that I have been thinking about this is that it's not just the likes of journalists who are affected, but it's also a whole range of other creatives. You've got directors and scriptwriters and production coordinators who work behind the scenes on not just news but drama, and it also connects to local communities as well. They've got a vast array of local radio stations, which New Zealand used to have, and then we kind of centralised, and now we're slowly going back to having journalists and storytellers around the country. So I would be so upset if the BBC was to change. And you did mention earlier, Wallace, about that whole connection between government and public broadcasters and being funded by the government. And here in New Zealand, the vast majority of media receives some form of funding from the government, whether that's fully funded like Radio New Zealand or via New Zealand On Air. It doesn't mean that we're not independent from them. It's not like we all get together with the politicians in the morning and decide what we're going to discuss that day. We are completely independent. And so I think there is a real need to look after the BBC. It's a taonga. It's important.
Final comment, Peter?
Well, I think the government is already showing signs of backtracking. I mean, there's been a huge backlash, you know, against Nadine Dorries' suggestion. I mean, the fact that she put it out on a tweet is indicative that this was not a well-developed policy, even though it's part of a much longer-term agenda. I'm hoping that eventually they'll be forced to listen to reason, but looking at the actions of the British government in response to COVID and other issues recently, I'm not holding my breath.
Nice to have you on, Dr. Thompson. Kia ora. That is Peter Thompson, who's the director of the communication program at Victoria University Wellington. Quite a bit of response about the licence fee recollections. In the late 90s, we had a TV licence man harass my flatmate and I for a few months. We wouldn't pay as we didn't have the TV hooked up to an An antenna, only VHS. He gave up in the end. Another one here. My flatmate had a TV that raised into the ceiling when not in use. The fee collector was sure there was a TV in the house, but he couldn't prove it. It's 5 to 5, the panel, RNZ National. Finally, calling all train spotters out there, this one's for you. A rare steam locomotive has arrived in Winton for a spruce-up. It's a D-Class Locomotive D6, which was built in Glasgow 142 years ago. Joining us to discuss this epic locomotive is the Lumsden Heritage Trust member, Rob Scott. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you, Wallace. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Very well. How are you? How big a deal is this?
Oh, it's awesome. Sitting here in sunny Southland with her. I haven't stopped smiling since Saturday when she rolled in back home. It's awesome.
Well, tell us how it rolled in. Picture by picture, frame by frame. Look at the train in your mind and tell us.
We've got what we refer to in the Heritage Trust as the A-team now, with all the different projects that we've done over the last sort of 10 to 12 years. And it came in on the back of Southland Machine Hire, the transporter, and it was a beautiful day in Winton, and I was standing there at the engineer's yard where it was coming into, and the bright yellow truck rolling around the corner with this beautiful beautiful locomotive sitting on the back. It was awesome.
Oh, although I've got to say, if that was me, I'd just look at it totally depressed, shoulders slumped, going, that's 10 years of work there.
Yeah, well, luckily for me, it's the engineer that's going to do the work, so I can still smile, but we've certainly got the right man on the job there.
Okay, good on you. There's nothing, Zoe George, like having the light in your eye when you have a passion project by restoring a 140-year-old locomotive, huh?
Oh, absolutely. I was going to say this. I have had the opportunity to stand in the cab of a steam engine at a steam ink in Pai Kakariki. One of my best friends is a hardcore steam train enthusiast, so I'm feeling the love right now. This is amazing. Can't wait to see it all finished when the project is done.
Rob?
Yep, and the sort of the golden bit about this is it actually gives us a complete train set in Lumsden of a heritage pre-1900s. Complete train, so we'll have the locomotive towing three pre-1900 carriages, so it's just going to be really unique on a worldwide stage. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Liam?
I have three boys who would be absolutely, I'm just looking at a picture of them now, I have three boys who would be absolutely amazed and delighted to go and see that one day. But I don't know what it is.
Bring them to Lumsden.
Kids have this innate fascination with trains, and they would love this one.
They do, and we watch them at Lumsden all the time. You see, and John's got our chairman's got a really good story of seeing a son and a father with the son standing on board there. We've got a diesel locomotive there at the moment, standing on board there, and the father standing on the carriage, and they're having a conversation about each other, and they're going, "We're going up a hill now, son. Crank her up," and just it was playing real life trains. It's awesome.
Yeah, we're all about Thomas the Tank Engine at our particular house. You know, I know the words off by heart. So my little boy too is going to be very excited about this. But tell us a little bit more about this D6, built in Glasgow 142 years ago. What else can you tell us about it?
So yes, it was built in 1880 in Scotland, and it served in Southland up until 1917. And then it shifted up to a coal mine in Clutha until 1940, and then from 1940 to 1965 it was at McDonald's Lime Company. So it sort of, when it finished its New Zealand Railway service, it went into the industrial kind of industry, and then finished up in 1965 with Ocean Beach Railway in Dunedin.
Amazing, so, Rob. Yeah. All the very best. Thanks for joining us. That is Rob Scott, involved in this 140-year-old D6. And a big thank you to Liam here and Zoe George. Kia ora to you both. Thanks for joining me.
Cheers.
Thank you. And also, no to savoury crumpets. Savoury crumpets are always sweet.
We might have to do the crumpet thing tomorrow, but the 5 o'clock report up next. Stay tuned to RNZ National. I'm with you 3:45 tomorrow. Till then, bye.